This is the Iran Human Rights Podcast, a closer look at major human rights issues by the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran. Children of the Jacaranda Tree is a stunning debut novel set in post-revolutionary Iran. Told in interconnected, alternating perspectives, the book follows three generations of men and women, some linked by family, others brought together by the tide of history that forces its way into their lives. The story follows political prisoners, not knowing whether torture, execution, or releases are on the corner, and caretakers on the outside, the grandparents and siblings holding their families together while their loved ones are imprisoned. The story moves from the nightmarish reign of terror and hellish secret prisons through the first ripples of new dissent some 30 years later, Iran's post-revolutionary generation, the children of the detained, repressed, and persecuted. At the novel's center is a single tragedy which leaves both the creators of the revolution and their children permanently scarred and traumatized. Drawing comparisons to The Kite Runner and In the Shadow of the Banyan, it's an evocative look at the intimate side of revolution. Today we'll speak with the author, Sahar Delajani, whose life and family inspired much of the book's narrative. Sahar, thanks for speaking with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
First off, I want to say this is a beautifully written book. It starts with the story of Azar, a political prisoner who gives birth in prison to a daughter named Nada. Now, this, like much of the book, is based on your own experiences.
Yeah, I mean, especially the first half of the book, which is based in the 80s, is very much based on my family's experience. The first chapter is my birth story. Yeah, my mom was pregnant with me when she was arrested in 1983. And so she gave birth in prison, I mean, the hospital of the prison. And then she was able to keep me for about a month and a few weeks. And then she gave me to my grandparents. And so, like, when I wanted to write this chapter, I asked her exactly what happened, how they took her to the hospital, what she was wearing, you know, all the details that I thought would be important to set the setting. And I got my own imagination involved and built upon those details to write it. And then the third chapter, which is based on my dad's and my uncle's experience together, because my uncle was executed in 1988 along with thousands of other people when the mass executions happened. So I wanted to write about him, and I asked my dad how, you know, it was in a prison and, you know, how everything happened. And also the bracelet of date stones that the character makes inside prison is actually a bracelet my dad made for me. I have that bracelet when he first saw me, you know, after I was born. So these two especially are based on this very intimate personal experience of my parents, of course, not mine.
So your parents were politically active?
Yeah, they were active before the revolution. And continued to, you know, their political activism after the revolution. They always belonged to the same political party. So they were active in a specific political party, but I don't like to disclose what party because, you know, this novel is about all the victims and not just one. And so, you know, my parents, it wasn't, you know, they didn't do anything, you know, very dramatic, giving out leaflets. My dad was a student at the time, so he's, you know, spoke at university to other people, you know, things like that.
One of your characters, Shaida, goes in search of her deceased father's past, and what she finds is something you just mentioned, that he's a victim of the mass execution of political prisoners that took place at the end of the Iran-Iraq War. It was also called the Death Committee. Now, this is an example of one of the many intersections of real-life events with the fiction in your book. Can you talk about this specific event?
Yes. I mean, you know, there was the mass arrests of political activists happened in 1983. Then, until 1988, there were executions. I mean, you know, continuous execution throughout these years. What happened in 1988 was that, like, the actual huge number of it happened. So the thousands in one summer were executed and buried in mass graves, and we still don't know how many people. The number goes from 4,000 to 12,000. And the reason we don't know is that, you know, having been buried in mass graves, the families knew more or less where the spot was, so they kept going back to that area. But a few years ago, the government, because they didn't want clashes with the families anymore, you know, because the families constantly went there, and they brought in a bulldozer and took everything away. So now we don't even know where the bodies are. So the Sheda story, I mean, that's, you know, that has never happened. I don't know anyone who didn't know that, you know, her father was executed. But why I wrote that story in that way was because so many Iranians don't know still what happened in that summer. And being it the last, you know, year of Iran-Iraq war, as you said, there was a lot of confusion going on. So it was the perfect opportunity. And these death committees were just a few people who sort of oversaw the so-called trials, you know. And the fact is that most of these political prisoners who went through these so-called trials had gone through a trial already. So, for example, my uncle had already been sentenced to 15 years. So he was just serving his term. And all of a sudden, they decided that they wanted to get rid of everyone. And in these trials, they would ask, you know, questions like, oh, are you a Muslim? Or do you fast? And things like that. And it wasn't like if you said yes to, you know, to are you a Muslim, for example, that it meant that you would be saved. It had nothing to do with your answers. It was just based on their impression of how repentant you are. And if they didn't feel like, oh, you're repenting what you have done, then they would execute you.
In your book, it's the character Amir who's killed during this sweep of executions. And his wife considers herself lucky that she actually gets a phone call from the prison telling her he's been hanged and telling her to pick up his belongings, because a lot of people never got answers about their loved ones who went missing in captivity.
Right. I mean, she didn't consider herself fortunate. Other people considered her fortunate because she had received this phone call. Yes, but there were also people who never received a phone call who went to prison to, you know, pay visit to the prisoner, and there they would find out that the prisoner had, you know, wasn't there anymore. And you know, what happened was that before these mass executions, that, you know, the concentration of it in that summer of 1988, they closed the prison doors for months, so nobody could had any news about the prisoners inside. And then some people got the phone call, like my family did, and, you know, they were asked to come to the prison and, you know, pick up the belongings of my uncle. And some people didn't, and just, you know, kept going back to prison every week to see what is going on, why are the doors closed. And then one day they would just, you know, sign this form, your, you know, son or daughter or whatever has been executed.
This storyline reminds me of things we hear coming out of Iran today.
I mean, yeah, that's the, you know, the very unfortunate thing about the Iranian history, that not much has changed. So after the 2009 protest, I mean, before that too, but, you know, the concentration again was after the 2009, you know, anti-regime and protest against the elections. There are still, you know, many, many political prisoners at this very moment in the Evin prison and other prisons, writers, activists, lawyers, doctors who have taken care of some prisoners inside prison at a certain moment, and so on. We still hear news of, you know, nobody is, you know, says, oh, they've been executed, but they say they died of heart attack, or they died of, you know, all kind of strange reasons that no one, of course, can confirm, because, you know, that these young people go into prison and we don't hear anything of them anymore. And then all of a sudden, you know, they had a heart attack, which is very strange. Of course, the families don't believe that. But the government never says, oh, we killed this person under torture, of course, you know. But a lot with that has happened. Many, many young protesters, especially who were arrested during the protests, died under torture these past years. So, not much has changed. And the same thing happens. One common point is that, again, when the parents or the family is given the belonging of that, dead person, they are denied any sort of mourning. They cannot hold a funeral or, mourn that person publicly, which was exactly what happened to my family. When my grandparents were given the belongings of my uncle, they were forbidden from, mourning my uncle in any way.
Now, that reminds me of the story of Sattar Beheshti, who was a blogger who died in custody in 2012, the suspicion being that he was tortured to death. His mother got a phone call just like that, saying, "Your son has died in prison. Come and collect his belongings." And I don't believe she was allowed to mourn him either.
Yes, but she did. I mean, his mother is incredibly courageous, and it actually goes beyond courage, because when you just lose your son like that, all of a sudden, without really knowing why and how, it goes beyond courage. You just want justice, and she's been very, very outspoken. About what happened to his to her to her son. And it's just really, really touching whenever I hear her speak.
It's interesting. If you follow the news coming out of Iran, you hear a lot of incredibly tragic stories like this one. And in a way, I feel your novel puts us into the headspace of people in similar situations, and in effect, allows us to truly empathize with them on a deeper level. What do you hope your readers can learn by looking back at the past like this?
Well, I think what I hope that they would learn is that, we need to know about the past in order to build our future. And it's impossible to get anywhere. I mean, in Iran at this very moment, it's impossible to get anywhere if we don't know what happened to thousands of young people just 20 years earlier. And that memory has to be kept alive because I believe that memory is a living thing. We have to carry it with us always. And if we do that, we would be more aware of how we want to build our present and our future. Because, past repeat itself, and it's just so evident in Iran. It's the best example of that. And I think if the Iranian society knew what had happened in 1988, we could have been a little bit more prepared for what was going to happen to us again in 2009 and in 2010. And that, by that, preparation, what does that mean? It's a very vague thing, but at the same time, at least mentally prepared before, for all these young people to go out, they needed to know what had happened to their parents in a way. And I think something that non-Iranians might find surprising is that the struggle for, for justice and democracy in Iran has been going on for a long time. That it is a country of fighters. We're not just, sitting there and tolerating and being submissive to governments who come and rule us. But we do believe in a better future, and we're working very hard for it and sacrificing a lot. And I think that a lot of non-Iranians would find that surprising because maybe they just think that, we sort of put up with everything, but we don't.
Well, this book is such a wonderful tribute to your uncle and to your parents, for that matter. They must be very proud.
Yes, they're very, very happy. They're very proud, yes. And I'm proud of them, because it's not easy to be a child of revolutionaries. What do you do? My parents overthrew a regime. I could write about it, and I'm very happy that they are satisfied with that writing, that me having put their experience into words, I'm happy that they believe that I've done justice to it because it's just, it's amazing what they've done and what they've gone through.
Sahar Delajani, thanks again for talking with me today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your wonderful questions.
That was Sahar Delajani, talking about her debut novel, Children of the Jacaranda Tree, which is available now in the US and the UK. That's all for this edition. For more news about human rights issues in Iran, visit our website at iranhumanrights.org. Join us next time for the Human Rights Podcast. Thanks for listening.